Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:46 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is March 11th. I'm taking a bit of gamble because the workers downstairs have set up the fire alarm a couple of times already today. So hopefully they're not going to do it within the next hour. But I thought we'd kick off today and look at the TED spread. This, of course, being the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes means that we should really be thinking about it in terms of the longer term. So the TED spread is the difference between the LIBOR, 3-month LIBOR, and 3-month Treasury notes. It's up to 44 basis points. It's often used as a measure of risk in the financial sector. So LIBOR is the rate at which banks lend to one another. And when one bank doesn't know how much the other bank has exposure to Russia, or perhaps they don't know how much exposure the bank's customers have to Russia, or the extent to which sanctions will be imposed upon those customers, or whether they will be penalized for not upholding the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia. Obviously, these are big uncertainties. So I know it would seem to be logical that banks would desire to take an additional premium for lending to one another on an overnight basis. So that's what we're seeing. It's up to 44 basis points. And we're at the upper side of, we're not quite at the upper side of the base formation, but we're approaching it. And we can look back at this period prior to the financial crisis, where we had low levels overall. Now, the one thing that's quite, I think, important to highlight is that peaks in these types of ratios, they are spreads, they coincide with market lows, but it's after the peak, or at least they're coincident, they're not lead indicators. And the higher the values go, the greater the likelihood is that there will be some kind of solution. But the fact that it is rising, and it's approaching that 50 basis point level, we're only 6 basis points away, it's beginning to hold out the prospect that we are looking at a liquidity challenge for the banking sector. So this is obviously something that we need to monitor. It's flashing yellow right now. It's not flashing red. If it starts to push through 50 basis points and then keeps going, well, then that's going to be flashing red. It would be a significant indicator that there is a problem with liquidity in the financial sector. And it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that that could occur. So then the bigger question would be, how quickly will the repo market respond? Now, the Federal Reserve has already confirmed that there is a standing repo facility. So it means that they're willing to backstop the entire global financial sector, but perhaps not Russia's. And of course, then will they extend credit to non-OECD countries? This, of course, is not exactly within their remit. The big currency or dollar swap lines that were set up over the course of the last 20 years, they don't really go into the non-OECD countries. There are certainly ways of getting money into places like India and other big countries, but a lot of the smaller countries just don't have the bandwidth to accept that kind of money, or at least access to credit or the developed financial sectors necessary to deal in that kind of volume. So we're certainly looking at potential issues arising. Now, then we can think about the FRA OIS spread. And if we just look at this on a 3-month basis, it's also rising, although it was a little bit tighter in here today. We're at about 22 basis points. And this is a big rangy environment as well, so we should go back and look at as much back history as we can get. And we can also see here that 40 basis points has generally tended to be about as high as it has gone for the last decade. Now, when we think about that, well, what is the FRA OIS spread? It's the forward rate agreement. So that's generally what people are willing to bet the rate will be in a certain, what the 3 month rate will be in 3 months time, for example, and then comparing it to what the overnight index swap is. So that would basically be overnight money. So it's beginning to think about what inflation looks like. It's beginning to think about what rates are, how rates are going to move. So this is obviously something that's really contributing to the inflation question. Everybody wants to know what central banks are going to do. We have really severe inflationary pressures arising. Inflation was already ramping higher because of the massive monetary and fiscal stimulus that was imposed during the credit, during the pandemic. And now with the measures to excise Russia from the global financial sector, particularly the OECD portion of it, well then that's contributing to even more inflation. And when we then think about what the yield curve spread looks like, there are, I think, some really rather interesting developments. So the 10-year minus the 2-year spread is down to 24 basis points, and it's still trending downwards. And it's trending downwards in really quite an accelerated fashion. So if things keep going the way they're going, it's going to give us a, or it's going to kickstart the countdown to the next recession before very long. But what we're also seeing here is that the 10-year minus the 3-month is actually increasing. And this is quite odd. We don't generally see this. In fact, usually the tightening is led by the 3-month. And it's because this measure is usually viewed as a lead and a more sensitive instrument than the 10-year minus 2-year. And it has also over time tended to give more false signals of future recessions. But it's going up, whereas the other one is going down. And we have to at least try and answer why this is happening, because these are two important lead indicators that are generally considered to be looking at the same thing, and they're moving in opposite directions. And I think that part of the reason for it is risk parity. And risk parity has been probably the best performing of the hedge fund strategies for decades. And we can look at this on a log scale on a monthly basis. And it has done spectacularly well for years. So what does risk parity do? They look at bonds and equities and the inverse correlation between the two, so that when stocks rise, bonds don't. When stocks fall, bonds rise. So then by netting off positions one against the other, weighting them by volatility, then you can create an index that does well in all weathers. But the problem is that the inverse correlation between bonds and equities appears to be breaking down. So when we zoom in and look at this on a daily basis, well, it was in positive territory today, but it is trading below the 200-day moving average. So if risk parity is not doing well, and we have to think that there are a lot of strategies around the world right now that are automated and are very much in tune with how risk parity operates, well, if you're losing money on your equity portfolio and you're losing money on your bond portfolio, well, then you're going to go to cash. And what that's going to do is it's going to push up the dollar, and the dollar remains really very firm. And it's up in a pretty dynamic manner this week and approaching the 100 level, which is the upper side of this range that's been forming for more than 6 years. And there's the potential here that it will at least test 100, and I think then we're going to have to see what happens. This has been an exceptionally lengthy range, and there has been a tendency for the dollar to move in 6 to 7 year, it's a 7 year bull market, bear market phase. But then there tends to be years in between where it does nothing. And then we get these 7 year advances. And again, there was another 7 year decline, a good long period of nothing, and then a good long move on the upside. And now we've had a lengthy period of rangy trading. One would normally think that after the bull market phase and a period of ranging, then we should anticipate there will be a downtrend, but it isn't going down right now. And it's not going down because people are selling stocks and they're selling bonds and they're just sitting in cash. Well, they're not just sitting in cash, they're sitting in near cash items. And if you're a bond portfolio manager, well, you don't want to hold hold 10-year yields when yields are rising, but you have to hold something. You're not allowed to hold cash. So what you're going to do is go either for the shortest possible duration, which is near cash. So then we can think about the 3-month yield has not broken higher. It peaked in February, and it's still trading below 40 basis points. And the Federal Reserve is expected to raise rates this month, and they're expected to raise them by 25 basis points. So that's fully priced in, and they're not really willing to price in more than about a half of another interest rate hike after that. So these are significant events where we're seeing a lot of demand for cash. And then we can also think about the other thing that people buy are floating rate notes. So if we look at a floating rate note ETF, then these are now also starting to deteriorate. And this is problematic. So people were wondering about how they could hedge their risk to interest rates. And interest rate risk is why you would buy floating rate notes, because their return or their yield, their coupon would rise in line with a hike in the interest rate. But if bonds are falling because people don't want to own them, well, that's not really a hedge against market risk. So this is problematic for bond investors. If you can't get security in the floating rate note sector, and you're not getting security in the long end of the curve, and when you think about the treasury or the TIPS yield, well, TIPS are offering at least some hedge. So people are continuing to support the TIPS market, and it is now back in negative territory. So when we think about the total number of bonds that are trading with negative yields, well, TIPS are in there in that mix. Now, when we look at the total number of bonds with negative yields, well, we're presented with a really significant change. I remember all the way back in 2015 and 2016, everybody was wondering how on earth anyone could justify buying a bond with a guaranteed loss implied in the purchase. And yet that's exactly what people were willing to do. Because you can buy a negative yielding bond, and provided the yield continues to get more negative, well, then you're actually making money, you're not losing money. So it's the bigger fool theory. And there were lots of bonds were trading at negative yields, and the total number of those of bonds that were trading at negative yields trended higher between 2014 and early 2021. We got up to a total of $17.5 trillion of bonds with negative yields, and now it's 4.5. So we've had an incredibly swift run up in yields for sovereign bonds over the course of the last 3 months. And this is obviously problematic because lots of people were willing to buy bonds with negative yields because they didn't really believe that they were going to have to deal with a big run up in yields in the short term. But what we've seen in just the last week has been a really big move in global government bond yields. So when we think about German Bunds, Germany probably benefited more than any other country from being able to borrow at a negative yield. So they had countries and funds from all over the world paying them to take their money. And this week we saw a really big upward dynamic. So we had a big compression last week and a big advance in here this week. And now the 200-day moving average is pretty close to pushing back above the 1,000-day moving average. And we should just look at this and go back to the period prior to the recovery in 2008, because that was the only time since the very early, or I guess, well, it's the middle of the 1990s, that the 200-day crossed above the 1,000-day. Now, on each of those occasions, particularly in 2007 and 8, we had an inflation scare. And back in 2007, we had surging oil prices. So we should pay attention to that. Oil prices have gone up in an exceptionally meaningful manner over the course of the last month, getting all the way up to test the $140 level. And that was coinciding with the peak from back in 2008. And particularly from the beginning of 2021, it's almost an identical advance, but in a shorter period of time from the acceleration that we saw in 2007 through to August of 2008, or July of 2008. So almost an identical advance in a shorter period of time. So what people will be very much aware of is that surging oil prices are a tax on consumption. And if we're talking about taxes on consumption, then that really contributes to slower economic growth. And now we can then put that into context of liquidity measures that are flashing yellow. And then if we are looking at financial conditions, they are rapidly tightening. Now, I would also caution against drawing the absolute conclusion that this surge in oil prices is enough to create a recession. Because if we look at oil on a purchasing power parity basis, we also get the big advance. But it is not the same advance that we had in 2007 and 8. So if we go back and get the back history, we can see that back in 2007, we had a much more aggressive period from higher values overall. That was the climax of a bull market that had been underway for 8 years already. Whereas what we've seen on this occasion is really a base formation completion on a purchasing power parity basis, because prices really haven't been going anywhere for the last 8 years. So if this breakout holds, well, it could yet accelerate additionally. And if we were to get back in short order to the peak from back in 2008 on a purchasing power parity basis, whether that is because of further sanctions on Russia or a greater intensification of the conflict, or even potentially a spreading of the conflict to additional countries, well, then that would obviously contribute to higher oil prices, and oil prices going up faster than they have already, or at least going up, and the pace of the advance persisting for a while longer, that would also contribute to a recession. So we're already seeing that the dollar is rising because of cash getting taken out. And the other thing is that the risk parity strategy is the primary buy the dip strategy, because it automatically starts to accumulate positions as volatility decreases. And that also means that it's just another way of saying that automated strategies will buy all day, all week, all month, provided volatility is low. And when volatility surges, they automatically have to sell. It's when volatility starts to come back down that they step back into the market, and they tend to then provide some of the clearest dip buying. Where we saw some of the biggest dip buying this week was in Europe. European indices rallied in a big way from the region of the 1,000-day moving average and the upper side of the 21-year base formation. So if the low holds that was put in this week, then we can conclude that this is a low of at least near-term and potentially medium-term significance for European markets. Now, I think it's important to highlight why Europe might be attractive. It's not certainly not because of its proximity to Ukraine, but it certainly trades on a lower valuation overall relative to the US market. So when we think about the Nasdaq, it was in negative territory today, and we're right back on the lows. And the trend up from the low in 2020 was really consistent until January of this year. And then we broke back into the underlying range, encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, and now we have resistance in the region of the MA, and then resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range twice. So now it's back on the region of the low, and it's going to have to rally in a big way next week, because otherwise we're looking at another new low. I think the base case has to be that the Nasdaq is going to unwind its overextension relative to the 1,000-day moving average, and then it will have to bounce. And not only bounce, but hold the low. So we're seeing a lot of the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market experiencing stress. I think perhaps more importantly than that, we are also seeing significant numbers of companies that did exceptionally well during the pandemic reporting lower guidance. So they don't believe that their business is going to continue to do as well as it did in 2021. And how could it? And the cloud computing sector is a perfect example of that. It's come back by about a third, and it's now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is where we might anticipate some support coming back in. But the problem for the sector is that it has a touch of the Y2K about the bull market environment. The sector did exceptionally well from 2012 to the peak, or I guess let's forget about the peak and just look at the period before the pandemic. The ETF was trading at 20, and within about 8 years, it had risen to about 70. So that's a good size move. And then between the low in 2020, or at least following the rebound, it more than doubled again. But it did that in a year. And that greatly accelerated the adoption of cloud. And really anyone who was going to adopt cloud services, I think a lot of them probably did it. Now, there are lots of companies that are involved in this sector, and a lot of them, and the trend of digitization in the global economy is going to persist. And it's certainly going to be important to have digital services in order to contain costs. So there's going to be a continued trend of growth in cloud computing and in the digitization trend overall. And there are lots of employees don't want to move back to the office. And that's also something that might help to contain some of the inflationary pressures. Or at least it might help to contain some of the risk that's experienced by the consumers from those inflationary pressures. Because if you're not driving your car for commuting every day, well, then you're just not spending the money on gasoline at all. Well, we're certainly in a corrective phase right now because the valuation went up a lot in 2021, and the valuation will have to correct, even though there is still the potential for this business to continue to be healthy in the future. We still need to see the unwind of the excesses that were put in during the pandemic. And I think this is what also the weakness on the NASDAQ is reflecting. Then we can think about the NASDAQ itself and the fact that cloud computing was one of the major components of it. So it's also leading the wider market lower. And both those sectors, they're big markets for chips. So the semiconductor index has been holding out better, but it's now also broken its sequence of higher reaction lows, and it's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, and it's had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, the move down from 4,000 to almost 3,000. Is the biggest decline it's had since 2020. So this is also looking like a medium-term top. So we're certainly looking at technology doing significantly less well, and anything that's considered a value play doing substantially better. So think, for example, about ArcelorMittal. I'm just taking it as one of the steel producers. It has an estimated PE of 3, and it pays a yield of about 1.25, and it's a $25 billion company. And the share has been going nowhere for a decade. But it's been consolidating nicely in the region of the upper side of the base formation for the last year. And it's been within the base for about a decade. Well, if the world is going to build a lot of super big wind farms offshore, we're basically building skyscrapers in the middle of the ocean, and that's extremely steel intensive. If China's serious about curtailing or modernizing their steel production, that's beneficial for all other steel producers. But perhaps more important than that, if the rest of the world has less of a friendly relationship with China, then that's something that could help to boost demand for domestic steel. So ArcelorMittal is one that's at the upper side of its base formation. Cleveland Cliffs is at the upper side of the first step above its base. Nucor is also, or I guess it has been the clear outperformer because it's had the benefit of really being more of a scrap steel producer. If steel is doing better, then we can think about some of the coal producers. So Whitehaven Coal has an estimated PE of 4 and pays a dividend of almost 2%, and the share is starting to recover. And it's been in this volatile, rangy environment for what feels like forever. Arch Coal has been rallying for quite some time already and accelerated in here this week because we're probably going to be burning coal for a lot longer than anybody ever thought was possible. So BTU also popped on the upside last week and then paused a little in here this week, but it's just breaking out of the first step above its own base formation. And I think it's, I don't know whether we're going to get the back history because so many of these companies went into bankruptcy and then came out of bankruptcy. But we've certainly seen the worst for the coal sector. And there are still pockets of distress within the coal sector. And in Indonesia, Bumi Resources has collapsed from its peak back in 2008, when it traded at 8,000 riyal. Today it's at 53, and they've just gone through a debt for equity swap. So the company is obviously not making any money, so there isn't going to be there isn't going to be a PE. But it's trading on a price to sales ratio of 0.3. So one reason that investors tend to shy away from these types of companies is that when you have exceptionally low PE ratios, it's because the market has discounted that the company's earnings are going to disappear. So, and if we think about steel and the challenge that Global Steel experience with the flood of steel coming through from China, well, that's obviously a challenge. But we're definitely seeing the price action starting to firm. And coal prices are doing well for a reason. So these are, I think, changes that are happening. The accepted knowledge in the sector is changing. And there is the real potential here that these represent really hard value plays. So when we start to look at these, I think it's important to look at the performance of gold shares relative to the Nasdaq, because they're coming from the lower side of the base formation. And this base formation that's been forming is really not all that far away from the lows that were put in 2000 and 2001. And in that period up from 2000 through to 2011, gold shares did substantially better than the Nasdaq. Now, miners, and particularly gold miners, are labeled with this, or have this label of capital destroyers. And it's an earned label. And there's a good reason for it, because they went out and borrowed a ton of money, and most of it was frittered away on trying to develop really exotic sources of supply, and it didn't work. So then they were way over-levered and losing money by the time the price of gold peaked and the sector collapsed. And it just happened to be around the same time that technology shares broke out. So we had a really profound bear market in gold shares relative to the best performing asset. But I think it's worth highlighting that since 2016, gold shares relative to the NASDAQ haven't really gone anywhere. Now, obviously, the NASDAQ has done exceptionally well, but relative to the gold shares, there's the potential here that they're going to outperform the NASDAQ. And if this ratio sustains a move above 0.1, well, then it will complete the base formation in much the same way that it was able to do in 2002. And that would represent a really profound change. But if gold shares do well, then other resources companies will do better, because in bull markets for commodities, then we would anticipate that copper would do better than gold. Now, gold at present is doing better than copper, and that's representative of the risk-off environment and the fact that gold prices have done well because of rising geopolitical tensions. And rising tensions aren't particularly beneficial for the global economy. So copper is currently not doing as well as gold, and it's easing back from the upper side of the base formation. But it is a base formation. And it's also worth reminding ourselves that between 2002 and 2006, copper way outperformed gold. And that was because of the industrialization of China, the rise of the global consumer, and synchronized global economic expansion. So it created a phenomenal demand growth driver for all commodities. So what is it that will drive copper demand growth in a similar fashion over the balance of this decade? Well, it could potentially be unwinding. So instead of looking at synchronized global economic expansion, we might be looking at progressive unzipping of reliance between countries. I don't think it's going to be as simple as tearing a page. I think it's going to be more like unzipping one rung at a time. So we've already seen some of that, where China is progressively moving towards independence. They want to be independent in energy and in technology. They've already built up their domestic consumer. And I think perhaps more important than all of that, they want to be independent financially. And that's, I think, part of the reason why a number of the big tech companies in China are deteriorating in terms of share price right now. So a lot of companies went to Wall Street to IPO. And Alibaba was certainly one of those, and it broke down in here today. Now, I thought that it was bottoming back in following that upward dynamic and upside Q reversal that we had in October. And that was wrong. And now it's still trending downwards. And JD.com came through with positive earnings in here this week and negative guidance, and the share broke downwards. So it did not find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. NetEase bounced yesterday and then gave up most of the advance, or the rebound in here today. So that's certainly significant that it is potentially failing in the lower side of this range. Baidu is another one of the US-listed Chinese companies that broke down in here this week. So we're seeing really quite a profound decline in Chinese-listed US-listed Chinese tech companies. And there's a lot of speculation about whether they're going to be forced to relist. But DD failed to relist, and the share halved. So what we're seeing is a deserting of interest in these Chinese companies. Now, of course, they're still going to be significantly large companies, and they're still going to dominate the consumer sector. But the other challenge is that the consumer sector is contracting, and property sales are falling. So China's going to have to do something to try and stimulate the economy. Now, they may go to Russia and say, if I was in charge, that's what I would try and do. I would go to Russia and say, we'll buy your commodities. We'll buy more of your oil. We'll buy more of the gas. We'll buy more of the palladium and the nickel. But what we want to do is, and we'll buy the wheat, but we'll pay you in renminbi. And what you'll do is you're going to recycle that renminbi and buy our bonds. And that would create the petro renminbi. In one broad stroke, they would internationalize the renminbi. Then you can think about Saudi Arabia. I'm going to post an article today which is mentioning the fact that President Biden refuses to talk to Mohammed bin Salman and will only talk to the very aged king, who's really no longer in charge. Now, not only is that a personal slight, but it's alienating the next generation. And all of this talk about a more enlightened foreign policy in the USA, and then the USA having to go cap in hand to countries like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Iran this week, not only does it come off as exceptionally weak, but you're basically treating with your enemies or with people that you purposefully insulted and asking them to do you a favor. And the world just doesn't work like that. But most particularly, you're asking countries to invest their own capital to do themselves a disservice by bringing down prices so that you can further your ambition to completely do without their product. So it's the market's equivalent of asking someone to dig their own grave. And we can't be too surprised that OPEC isn't going to agree to that. And the bulk of growth in demand for energy is coming from the non-OPEC sector. The one thing that it struck me as peculiar when I was in Riyadh is I met a number of people who work for the Public Investment Fund, which is Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. And they were all Chinese. So they're mainland Chinese people. They were exceptionally well-educated, smart people who spoke perfect English. And they work for China, for Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. So Saudi Arabia is sitting in between Russia and China and Europe and selling a vital commodity and attempting to play all sides, trying to keep everybody happy. But the question would be, what's it going to take for Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states to begin accepting renminbi for what they sell to China and dollars and euros for what they sell everywhere else? That's an enormously big question. Because what we are potentially looking at is the birth of a petro renminbi and the demise of the petro dollar. Now, the petro dollar is greatly enhanced by the USA's ability to export. But the domestic energy sector is also being alienated. So they've been banned from drilling on federal land. And they're pretty much refusing to increase supply at present. So there is likely to be some form of carrot asked or desired by these companies. And getting the ability to drill on federal land once more is probably going to be the thing they ask for. So both Devon Energy and EOG Resources continue to trend higher, although they were a little softer in here today. And the other portion of the petrodollar system, of course, is treasuries. And the 10-year treasury continues to trend higher, and it was up in a really dynamic manner in here right now. So any country that's holding treasury bonds is losing money. And yields have been trending higher now for 2 years. And this was a whopping big upward dynamic in here this week. So what this is basically is investors are betting that the Federal Reserve will not do what is necessary to curtail inflation. So they may raise rates once, and I've been saying since at least January, and potentially, I can't even remember when I started saying it, but I think it's going to be one and done. And if that's the case, and CPI inflation is at 7.9%, and that was before the commodity boom started, then we're certainly in an environment where liquidity conditions are tightening. We've seen plenty of evidence of that, and financial conditions were about as accommodative as they could possibly be at the end of last year, and this measure is trending higher now in a really profound manner. And then we can think about what happens in terms of the yield curve spread, where we've had this exceptional difference between the 10-year and the 2-year and the 10-year and the 3-month. And that 3-month yield hasn't been rising quickly because of the desire for near cash items. So financial conditions are tightening. And everything that we're looking at is pointing towards that fact. And investors are going to cash and they're getting out of bonds. And the stock market is only beginning to price that in. What we're looking at is the real potential that there is going to be slowing growth. And I look then at what Amazon did yesterday, where they said that they were going to buy back $10 billion worth of their shares, which on the scale of things is nothing. But then they announced that they're going to go and do a 20-for-1 stock split. So that helped the share to rebound, and it got it back up towards the 3,000 level. But it's going to do nothing to improve the outlook for the company. Amazon's primary profit center is cloud services. Amazon Web Services is where the vast majority of the profit comes from, and the cloud business is not going to grow the same way it has been for the last 12 months. And liquidity is tightening. The consumer is pressured by higher oil prices. So it means they're buying less crap on Amazon. Now, I know from Mrs. Tracy's business that her business has been suffering from greater competition because her Fist product was so successful that it encouraged some competition. But she's down 28% year over year. That's not all competition. It's also lower demand. So that's certainly a significant factor that we're starting to see that on a year-over-year basis, sales are starting to deteriorate. And this is also evident in other very retail-heavy focused website companies. So Shopify is rapidly pulling back. It peaked at 1750 and it's down to test 500. And even then, it's still trading at a really aggressive multiple. So if we think about the PE, the estimated PE is still at 147. Etsy is also under quite a bit of pressure as well. So, also breaking, or not quite breaking down, but certainly coming back down in a rather big way in here to test the 1,000-day moving average again. And Walmart, which is the low-cost seller, and has clearly stated that they think that they will benefit from this inflationary environment because they will be the lowest cost seller of goods. Well, the share isn't really going anywhere. It's rebounded over the course of the last 2 weeks, but it's been ranging rather than trending. And it did exceptionally well between 2016 and 2021 as well. So I think we're in a more difficult environment. And the kinds of sectors that will do well are those that are levered to benefiting from the inability of central banks to do what they need to do to contain inflation. So gold rocketed higher in February and early March. It got up to test the all-time peak above 2000 and then paused. And this doesn't look like anything other than a pause. I think that it is exceptionally likely that we're going to see gold breaking out and then running in a big way. And I think that on this occasion, it is going to take out the all-time peak in terms of purchasing power parity. And let me see if I can get this chart up on a monthly basis. That would take out the peak from 2020. It would take out the peak from 2011. And it would take out the peak from 1980. So that would be the first big leg higher in gold in terms of purchasing power parity. And it would be in response to the loss of faith in fiat currencies. I think this is a really quite profound change. I've had interesting conversations this week with people that are attempting to create a futures contract in diamonds. And in an environment where we have a loss of faith in fiat currencies, hard assets that have limited supply are going to attract greater interest. So this is something that is there are solutions evolving in terms of how to protect oneself. There are value propositions in the resources sector where some of the portions of the market have been beaten up in really quite an exceptional manner. So if we think, for example, for Euronav, which has some of the, or I think it has the biggest fleet of very large oil tankers, and the share got all the way up to test the upper side of its base formation this week and then pulled back. So tankers are a difficult business, and particularly when there is talk of imports being banned from Russia, well then that's going to result in less demand for ships. Of course, Russia will then be hiring ships or buying ships for oil storage because they'll have nowhere to put it. So then that will also remove some supply from the market. But what the share prices are telling us is that nothing is happening just now in this portion of the market. But there's lots of action in the other portions of the shipping sector. And Maersk bounced really quite impressively from the region of the 200-day moving average in here this week. So we're certainly seeing greater interest in the resources sector, and particularly in value plays. So Europe bounced from the 1,000-day moving average, and it's obviously got some work to do to put some support in. And Japan also trades on a much lower multiple than the Nasdaq does. And it's also in the region of the 1,000-day moving average and the upper side of the underlying trading range on that Nikkei index. And the Topics is also back testing the upper side of its underlying trading range. But these are markets that trade on lower valuations. So they've had somewhat shallower pullbacks. They're back in areas of potential support. The dollar is rallying now because people are moving to cash. Ultimately, we're going to see less cash, more deleveraging, and greater appetite for alternatives. If we are unwinding from Russia and China, and we're seeing the true development of a multipolar world, where there is another Cold War emerging, it means that the OECD needs to become much more independent in terms of everything. And that's going to start with commodities, metals, fabrication, manufacturing, processing, and those are the things that were outsourced over the course of globalization. They'll have to be insourced. That means that the obstacles to developing new mining capacity and infrastructure will have to come down. And until it comes down, it means that the existing infrastructure and the existing companies will trade at a premium, which probably means that their low valuations are not going to last all that much longer. And I think this chart is also particularly relevant. If we look at the NASDAQ relative to gold, I know we looked at gold shares relative to the NASDAQ, but the NASDAQ now is back testing the 1,000-day moving average and the upper side of the underlying range relative to gold. If we think about the MSCI ex-US gold, it has already broken downwards, and realistically, it never really broke upwards. It's coming back down towards the lower side of the base formation. And really, we're already back in single digits. So the Dow gold ratio has also rolled over. And this certainly changes the outlook, because the really big leader in the bull market was the NASDAQ. And if that breaks its 1,000-day moving average and moreover encounters resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, well, then it would be just impossible to make the case that there's a secular bull market in technology relative to gold. If that's the case, then we have to then prepare for the reality that we're in a new commodity bull market. That not only are we in a new commodity bull market that is going to be pioneered by demand for the resources required for renewable energy, but that we're going to see an advance in demand for just about everything. And there will be a significant loss of confidence in fiat currencies. And we are going to start to talk much more about financial repression. And that is something that is really going to start to move front and center, because people are losing a lot of money in bonds and they're losing money in stocks. Commodities are rising and commodity shares are cheap. And if we start to see yields rising, it introduces a discount rate back into the valuation model. And that's when value tends to do best. So when we then think just simply about just comparing a value ETF relative to growth, we've had a significant move higher, and it's at a new recovery high in here this week. We're potentially on the cusp now of value outperforming growth, and that will have profound effects on how portfolios are structured over the balance of this decade. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you. And I do hope that by this time next week, I'll be at the end of the banging in my house and into more of the quieter reconstruction phase. Thank you.